Accession number 28653, Mr. Francis Lucas, Realt 9. Now, what happened? We got to Swaffham, and you'd moved your wife there. Now, what were you doing at Swaffham? What was the unit doing at Swaffham?
Well, it was a very easy, relaxed time. I suppose the answer was it was more domestic than anything else. Although, in theory, it turned out that it should have been a period of preliminary training for whatever. And we weren't sure at that time what the whatever was. But in point of fact, it was a very relaxed time. And we all tended to find friends with local people, who of course were very hospitable and generous. And where I was concerned, it was very pleasant, because Dillis, my wife, was up with me. And that made a most pleasant interlude after the long time previously when we'd been separated. So my memory of it would be of a very warm memory of hospitable people and a very relaxed time, quite frankly. And I suppose, if I'm honest, none of us thought too much about training or whatever. We just accepted it as a most pleasant interlude.
So how long did this go on for? You got back about January 44.
Yes. This went on for about 2 months, I suppose. Perhaps a little bit more. And then we realised that things were beginning to get more organised and that there was something being planned ahead. Just what? We didn't know. And then, finally, we were advised that there was being planned and in line for us a further operation, which it was expected would take us across the Channel and to be involved in France. But beyond that, at that stage, we knew nothing at all.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, did it worry you?
No. Oh, quite reverse. Everyone, I think, was really looking forward to some meaningful activity again. Whilst we enjoyed the domestic side, and that was very pleasant, I mean, we all realised that wasn't the real point. We're in the army, and everyone felt, boy, let's get on with this. We want to get out, want to get home, and it was obvious that much more had to be done to achieve that objective.
So what happens next then? You get the notification?
Eventually, and I'm not sure the exact date, we were given about a week's notice that we were going down to the London area, and we were advised to get our trucks and equipment all in tidy and good order, and so it was indeed quite a busy week. Split in two areas, of course. One, the fond farewells of the local people, and again, getting our trucks fitted up and ready for whatever might lie ahead. And then it was interesting. We didn't quite know where we were going to down south, but the day came when we departed, actually over a period of 3 days with various sections of our unit, and we landed up in the East Ham Stadium, the old football stadium in East London.
Now, roughly when would this be?
Roughly that would have been sometime in April, I would guess, around the April period. And so we came into East Ham Stadium. And it soon became evident that it wasn't such a temporary place of abode, but we were being incarcerated there. And we felt almost that we were taken into a sort of prison camp, believe it or not.
Now, in what way? What sort of security arrangements were there that were so onerous?
The security arrangements there were such as caused our lads extreme exasperation. We're in the stadium, and it was a fairly old, clapped-out place at that time, with a corrugated iron fence around most of it, and in the midst of a residential area, really. But the humiliating thing was this, that when we got there, initially, we were not allowed to have leave, we're not allowed to go out at all, and the ultimate humiliation for our lads was the fact the Home Guard were providing external security. Now, the Home Guard did a good job. Obviously they did. But for our lads who'd been in the desert at Alamein, had been up through Italy, and goodness knows where, to be literally guarded by the Home Guard was a height of humiliation. Now, our lads being the lads they were, they soon devised alternatives. We didn't know at that time how long we would be there, but we were advised that in due course, whatever that meant, that we would be going on the next phase of active operations. But we were unaware of how long we would be in the stadium. And what happened? Home Guard lads on bikes and so on rode around the external part of the stadium and just kept an eye on things. But with the initiative that our lads had, a number of escape routes were soon established, because at that stage we're not even allowed to leave. And in various parts of the stadium, the corrugated iron fence which enclosed it ran across the bottom of the gardens of some of the houses in the area. And it didn't take much initiative to be able to clamber over the fence. The folk over the other side were, of course, very friendly, very helpful, and a number of recognized escape routes were established where your truck would be pulled up towards the fence itself, and on the tailboard you would vault onto the top and over, usually onto the roof of a chicken hut or something which is not in their garden. And you would walk up through their back garden, give a tap on the door. The folk inside would be very cooperative. They'd go to the front window, look out for you, and tell you when one of the guards has cycled by, and then you would just nip out, and you're outside and comparatively free.
Now, it sounds like you did this.
I did indeed, on a number of occasions, and in the end, with quite an amusing sequel. And so, for quite a long time, must have been 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, that was the routine that was established, with the friendly relationships of the folk whose houses and gardens adjoined the stadium. Now, it so happened, where I personally was concerned, I had an old aunt that lived in Holloway, North London. And I, therefore, took the opportunity of visiting aunt, who was very, very pleased to see me and very hospitable. And so we had this routine. We would take it in turns amongst our lads, be away for an evening. Of many of the lads, I'm afraid, they would be away for a complete night, and had obviously found some acceptable place to bed down. The rest you leave your imagination. And so, that is how things develop. Now, it so happened that my aunt had a little radio set, and it also happened that it developed a fault. And so I said to her, "That's all right, aunt. I can take it back to our workshop truck, and I'll get it repaired for you, and I'll return it to you in due course," which I did. I brought it back. And then things became a little difficult within the area, the camp itself. Our lads, although many used its escape routes, got utterly frustrated with petty disciplines, etc. They felt that they had borne so much of the action out in North Africa, Italy, and so on, and be treated as they were treated under petty discipline was irritating. And there was a very big ruler in the camp, a ruler which had been used, obviously, for the football pitch. And on one notable occasion, which is recorded in a semi-facetious but quite factual way in the issue of Coggage.
Now, this is a magazine produced a sort of year later, Coggage, which we have issues 2, 3 and 4 deposited in your collection in documents, which you've given us. So exactly. People can look there for themselves to see that. But carry on. So it was later on. And it was article.
That's right. And so there were very big, again, iron gates, the main entrance of the stadium. And there was a slope down towards those gates. And the lads got the very big roller, and with much shouting and hooing and so on, they pushed it down towards the gates and crashed them open. Immediately, there was an absolute flap. The few officers around certainly did flap. One of them indeed drew his revolver. And the Home Guard who were around made themselves a bit scarce outside the gates. But the thing is, the gates were crashed open with this road there. And all the lads just piled out into the road. I think the powers that be thought there was going to be a revolution or something. But in point of fact, when they had achieved this, the lads gathered outside, just chatting and smoking and so on, and there was no real problem. They'd achieved their object, they'd made their point, they'd broken out of this place. The result the next day was unbelievable. By early afternoon, a whole program of entertainments being put on. The main comedians and other artists of the day had been quickly commissioned. People like Tommy Trinder and so on, the well-known comedian, and others, and a whole series of entertainments, concerts, and goodness knows what was put on for the lads. And to a great extent, that just helped the atmosphere and so on. The nightly escapes still continued, of course, over the fence and up through the back gardens of the people, where the lads still maintained their links that they'd established. But that resolved the situation and the frustrations to a very great extent. Now, as I say, I have my aunt's radio set. And it was being repaired by our lads on the workshop truck. There's a bit of delay because they had to fabricate some required components, etc. And then, without previous warning, suddenly there's a clampdown that We were advised, and it was well known that the lads did escape, we were advised that now there is strict security, and in a couple of days we would be departing for the docks. Now that caused a problem for quite a number. External security was increased out of all recognition. A group of military police were brought in that, again, patrolled the outside to stop people escaping, etc. And so that did cause a few, what one might say, domestic problems, etc. Now, in my own case, I had my aunt's radio set. I thought, boy, I must get it to her. This is impossible to just let her down like that. And so I decided on the second evening of this clampdown that nevertheless I must get out. And so the radio set was duly packed up so I could carry it. I used the usual escape route. I went up through the house of the people who surveyed the road outside and advised me when the coast seemed to be clear, and out I went. Now, there was a bus stop we normally use a few hundred yards down the road, just around the corner. And so I made for that bus stop. As I turned the corner, to my horror, I saw a group of military police down there, standing at the bus stop. They knew, obviously, that's where the lads be making for. And, of course, immediately spotted me. And I thought, wow, I've had it now. Poor Auntie Set. I won't be able to get it to her. And being me, I did what I usually did in such situations. I couldn't drink physically. So I gave a short prayer. Lord, for goodness sake, help me out of this situation. And I had no alternative but to walk with a steady gait down towards the bus stop, in as I knew the arms of the military police were just obviously spotted and waiting for me. And then I suppose, I don't know, perhaps I was a couple of hundred yards away, I was walking down this path, and they pulled in beside me a little van, and it was a milkman's van, and it was driven by a milk lady who just got out, was going to get out the cab, and it was just a few yards in front of me. I immediately, that hesitation, opened the passenger door, sat in, and she said to me, "What's the game, soldier?" I said, "Turn round quickly." Now, she was one of those bright Cockney girls. She let in the clutch, and within yards of the bus stop, she turned round, and we went off in the other direction. Said, "Where do you want to go?" Well, I said, "The nearest tube station." So she dropped me at the nearest tube station, and cut a long story short, of course, I delivered the radio set to my good aunt in Holloway, who was very grateful and had no great problem in making my way back. Just a couple of days after that we were due to leave, and in various sections we left and were taken down to the docks and so on and embarked. We were advised then that we were indeed going over somewhere on the Normandy coast. And so we all, our vehicles were loaded on what they called Liberty ships, weren't they? On these Liberty ships. And my own unit was all together. And in a way, we were relieved and quite thrilled to be on our way to doing something positive.
And when was this? Was this the sort of day before D-Day?
This would have been... This would have been, as it turned out, 2 days before D-Day.
Because there was a day's delay, wasn't there?
That's right. And so we sailed not quite knowing, of course, the precise direction, beyond knowing that it was somewhere towards the Normandy coast. And then the weather was very bad for a period, and there's quite a bit of seasickness, etc. But anyway, the spirits of the lads were quite good.
Now, did you stay out at sea during the extra day, or what did you do?
We just seemed to be, of course, we didn't know the routine, we just seemed to be swanning aimlessly around. And there were a number of protection vessels around too, but amazingly enough, we saw no precise action. Things really were quiet. And there's a group of about half a dozen of these Liberty ships with us, and so we just appeared to be hanging around.
Now, did you suffer from seasickness at all? How are you?
I did, and most of us did, and it did put us off eating any army rations.
How bad was it? How bad? Because, you know,
oh, I suppose in retrospect, not impossibly bad, but some of our lads were really, really quite clapped out with it. But it didn't affect me too badly, but, you know, your tummy was all out of order, etc.
And how what was morale like? You mentioned briefly, but, I mean, how did you feel? How did they feel? I mean...
The seasickness put a bit of a damper on it. But in point of fact, everyone seemed jolly thrilled and jolly keen to be doing something.
And
strangely
what
enough...
What about yourself?
Where I was concerned... yes, I was glad that we would be back actively doing something. I looked forward again to being with the lads in the workshop truck and around. And yes, there was that sense of anticipation. You didn't know what lie ahead. We didn't know what was going to be involved in landing on the beaches. And in any case, you didn't worry. You just took things as they came.
I presume your religion was a bit of a help to you in sort of looking forward to this sort of trial.
Oh, unquestionably, yes. As a group, as a team, you really did pull together, and I had a very good team. Just one lad was always a bit of a problem, and that was Dick Turpin, and Dick Turpin was the elder brother of Randolph Turpin, who ran back that time, was the middleweight champion and so on.
You've mentioned him, yeah.
Yes, I had mentioned Dick before. But I had a new driver, a lad named Peter Creek, a young Cockney lad who was a very good young lad. Not such a good driver, but he's a good lad.
So what happens? You're sailing about, not much happening.
That's right. And until finally, and we weren't advised of what was happening, finally it was obvious now that we were going somewhere. And we were advised that within the next 2 or 3 hours we would be meeting tank landing craft, that our vehicles would be lifted off, and that we would be taken ashore. We had no clue of what that really involved and so on, but that was the situation, and you just, in a way, look forward to the activity of it, because there's nothing worse than inactivity. So
where did this transshipping to tank landing craft take place? Was that off the French coast? Or whereabouts were you?
So, eventually, the coast of France came in sight. I find it difficult to say how far, but there's a rendezvous then with the tank landing craft. They pulled, we hove to, and all the vessels did, and they pulled alongside us, and the cranes went from the hold, lifted up our vehicles one by one, swung them over the side, and deposited them on the deck of the tank landing craft. That was quite a tricky affair, because with the swell of the sea, the two vessels were moving up and down, not exactly in unison, and they had to just gauge the right moment to drop the vehicle quickly down onto the deck of the landing craft when it was moving in the right direction. But anyway, that was achieved in due course, and then we ourselves got over the side and just entered into our vehicles, and our tank landing craft then made for the shore. We were conscious of the fact that there was extreme activity. I well remember it, extreme activity overhead. The sky seemed to be alive with our planes and so on. And as it transpired, things were obviously not as bad as initially, because, as we later understood, this was D plus one. We were not aware of what had happened on D-Day itself.
So you were landing on July the 7th, so you'd been at sea for nearly 3 days.
That's right, yes, yes. And so on D plus one, sometime, we were on the tank landing craft and making towards the shore. And the nearer we got, we realized that there had been extreme problems probably the day before with the debris that you saw, with some vehicles still floating about, etc., occasionally a body, and so on. And we realized that things had been very serious, and indeed that things were a bit naughty even then.
And whereabouts were you landing?
Due to land on Gold Beach. Now, Gold Beach adjoined the beach allocated to the Canadians, as Gold Beach and the Canadian Beach. I should remember, I should have checked up before our chat here, the beaches. I was once well aware of them. Anyway, where we were concerned, together with dozens of others, our tank landing craft were making towards the shore.